2. Deliberate space. Jimmy Fryer Esquire, walking along a telegraph wire, with his shirt on fire. I have used the word gesture in Chapter 1 to describe those aspects of the nature of language other than those covered by dictionary definition and word order. These gestures are similar to the physical gestures and tones of voice in conversation. Obviously, it is common and important that we use clear, cold instrumental language in everyday life, so that we know to meet inside or outside a cinema, or take two per day after, not before meals. But, as we have seen, little or no communication is confined to transmitting information in this way. All the resources of verse emphasize the gesturing elements of words and their combinations in ways that draw attention and impress. These include sound effects like alliteration and assonance, repetition, rhyme, rhythm, and meter, figures of speech or tropes, limericks, sonnets, haiku, and all the other verse forms that we shall meet later. Even poems that do not manifest such features so obviously, or indeed aim to avoid them altogether, are still shaping words in some deliberate forms. This chapter will suggest that poetry can be seen as a particular space, created or adapted by the poet out of the flux of language use with great deliberation. A poem is a part of the functioning and the gesturing of the words we use every day, but it is also set aside. Just as a prayer mat is made of fabric found everywhere, but once laid out, marks off a space from the surrounding daily world, so does the shape of the poem organize language into a space for pause and for different attention. It is a space in time, just as the prayer is, one marked by the rhythms of pace and pause, and the sensations and ideas in every word. This space is shaped in the mind of poet and listener, and when the poet occupies a physical space on the page, its impression is also in the formation made by the letters. Some poems exist primarily or even entirely in visual space, and have virtually no temporal existence. Just other poems have their life entirely in the time of the voice, rather than the written page. In later chapters, we shall note the various features which mark out this space and fill it. But first, I want to explore what this space might be, and the kind of effects it creates. I shall begin where poetry began, in oral recitation and performance. I shall look at children's rhymes and oral poetry from Britain and elsewhere, and move from that to look at how strongly visual spaces are created in the familiar space of the printed page. Oral tradition and children's rhymes. As we may note from Jimmy Fryer Esquire, walking along a telegraph wire with his shirt on fire. A prime motive for manipulating words in gestural ways is pleasure. The simple, sensuous exhilaration that comes of making up such a combination of sense and sound, or of adapting it, or certainly of uttering it. The delight in this verse comes from the semantic absurdity. The picture of the words show us of someone walking along a telegraph wire, perhaps as yet unaware of his predicament, is just wonderfully silly, just like the man with the bucket on his head. Besides the relish of others' discomfiture, which is so much a part of children's catcalling, the image's impossibility is also part of its pleasure. Words can be put together in ways that offer a little holiday from reality, a momentary fantasy. But there is more to it than this. Certain manipulations are more effective than others. The sound, timing, and rhythm, for example, are all crucial. Poetry works on the ear. It is a form developed for and in performance, within a long oral tradition. To understand the effects of these oral origins, we can return to the playground and Jimmy Fryer. As we have said, the rhyme offers a certain pleasure through the absurdity of what it describes. But the coincidence of the word sounds is no less striking. The name Friar offers the chance of the rhythms of Esquire, Fire and Wire, although it is just as likely that in earlier versions of the joke the point was to mock the use of the pompous title Esquire. It could easily be adapted, for example, to read Geoffrey Wainwright Esquire, walking along a telegraph wire with his shirt on fire. The gender of Esquire would present a momentary problem, but it's easy to imagine such further adaptations as Kylie Fryer Esquire, walking along a telegraph wire with her skirt on fire. The schoolyard poet would certainly substitute skirt, not dress. Any polysyllabic word, like overcoat or handbag, would certainly make the line a clumsy mouthful, and not all monosyllables are equal. The lighter vowel sound and the softer slipping away s of s would dissolve the mocking bite of harder sounding words like skirt or shirt. Of such details are successful verses made. And the ear for it is vitally related to the fact that children's verses have an oral existence. Their precision has been honed by repetition, and the fact that the playground can be a very critical arena. With one verbal slip, the mocker could instantly become the mocked. Imagine, for instance, the embarrassment of a child eager to pass on this rhyme, "Good King Wenceslas, knocked a Bobby senseless, right in the middle of Marks and Spencer's." Who remembers the content, but not the exact words, and puts in policeman or constable for Bobby. The rhythm of the second line would stumble disastrously. It is the predicament of the bad joke teller. Jokes often turn upon features of language, most obviously puns, which makes them cousin to the wordplay of poetry. But we all know that it's the way you tell them, and so it is. The ability to structure and, above all, time a joke is vital to its success. It is the cadence, the arrangement of acceleration and pause, and the manipulation of time that matters. The space of these children's rhymes is shaped very precisely to meet these requirements of timing. They choose words with an exact ear for the cadence, the way each sound falls in relation to the ones that surround it. I have emphasized so far the continuity between the gestural features of speech and of poetry, and suggested that in familiar children's rhymes, we can see the attraction of verbal gesture in poetic features, such as rhyme and rhythm. Yet just as these verses delight in the peculiarity with which they are constructed, so does their content in the space they occupy in the child's mind. The oddity of King Wenceslas, abandoning, wherever and whenever it is he comes from, and embarrassing the law, in a respectable store like Marks and Spencer's, is a child's cheerful transgression against adult authority, as represented by carol singing and policemen. The happy coincidence that Wenceslas rhymes with senseless and Spencer's parallels this little disorder because it is in the character of rhyme to be anarchic. By anarchic, I mean that because rhyming words have no necessary connection in meaning, following the quest for a rhyme can lead the solemn progress of meaning in quite a different, coincidental direction. We shall look at this in more detail in Chapter 6 on rhyme. We can see the way the forms of children's verses can coincide with their ideas to tweak the nose of the adult world in what Iona and Peter Opie, in their classic study, The Law and Language of School Children, call Tangle Talk. This verse travesties the kind of speech-making not unknown in their school halls. Ladles and jelly spoons, I stand upon this speech to make a platform. The train I arrived in has not yet come, so I took a bus and walked. I come before you to stand behind you and tell you something I know nothing about. The space of the poem is deliberately separated from the current of ordinary speech by the way it is shaped. Here, the prose norm of conventional speech is broken into the segments as the children heard them to form separate lines. Often, too, the poem is marked off from the sphere of daily expectation by the alternative imaginative space that it occupies. As the dignitary rises to speak, the children, sitting in their obedient rows, hear something different in their heads. It probably makes little sense to them anyway, so they take this to an extreme by mixing or tangling it up, substituting words that sound similar to produce a nonsensical parody. Sometimes, it is a more fantastic space, a realm where pigs take snuff to make them tough and the elephant a pretty bird, builds its nest in a rhubarb tree and whistles like a cow. All this kind of fancy and such bold language strokes might be seen to have something in common with another delight of children, cartoon animation. Everything about the words is larger, more obvious, and the action improbably dramatic. Drawing again upon children's rhymes, a simple example of a clapping song can teach a great deal about the fundamental and powerful poetic techniques used in the oral tradition to impress stories upon listeners. When Susie was a baby Susie was, and she went wah, 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 wah. When Susie was an infant Susie was, and she went scribble, 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 scribble. When Susie was a junior Susie was, and she went, miss, miss, I can't do this, I've got my knickers in an awful twist. When Susie was a teenager she was, and she went, oh, ah, I've lost my bra, I've left my knickers in my boyfriend's car. The rhyme goes on through Susie as a mother, granny, skeleton, and ghost. The remarkable, simple economy of this life story is achieved by a number of techniques. Fundamentally, we have the signposting structures of repetition, when Susie was, when Susie was, to introduce each phase of her life. Allied to that is the strong beat on these syllables in the when lines. When Susie was a baby Susie was, which coincides with the claps. Interestingly, the inversion of the first phrase of this line in its second phrase is in fact a familiar device in classical rhetoric, where it is known as anadiplosis. But reiteration can also be tedious, and variation is necessary if the attention of an audience and of a performer is to be held. In Susie, the wah-wah and scribble-scribble pattern soon looks likely to be boring, hence the shift of phrase and of rhythm with, and she went, miss, miss, I can't do this. I've got my knickers in an awful twist. These lines alter the rhythmic pattern and introduce rhyme at the same time as they take the girl out of infancy. All of these iterative techniques also work as a stalling device, which helps the clappers to be sure they remember the next line. Indeed, this whole clapping song is a small-scale instance of the memorizing or mnemonic qualities of oral recitation. Poetry is far more ancient than print or even written cultures, and it is devices such as rhythm, beat, and recurrent structure that enable singers, clappers, and storytellers to organize and remember their material for the audience. Orality is the major reason for the primacy of the verse line. We shall look at this in detail in chapters 4 and 5. A recurrent pattern defined by repeating sequences of beats, together with related oral effects, such as rhyme and other formulaic constructions, enabled the pre-literate makers of poetry not only to remember their lines, but also to hold their audience. We still use mnemonics as an aid to memory, as in this old history lesson revision aid. In 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue, and we know that verse in set forms is easier to memorize than prose. So, the clappers of Susie, with some 20-plus lines to remember, have beat, rhythm, reiteration of both phrase, and structure to help them through the narrative, which is in any case structured by its progress through the span of a life. Oral tradition in epic and narrative. If we turn to the great stories of ancient Greece and other communities told for generations before they were ever written down, we can understand more about how the space of poetry has organized for large and lengthy purposes. We shall see that remembering is hardly an accurate term for the way in which these oral poems of the past existed within their tradition. Perhaps the poems best known to us of the ancient oral tradition are the Greek heroic epics, attributed to Homer, the Iliad, which tells the story of the Greeks' long war against Troy, and the Odyssey, which recounts the protracted voyage home from Troy of its hero Odysseus. These are poems which, in present-day conventional English editions, will occupy some 450 pages each. But they existed long before they were written down, in the 6th century BC, only in the mind and voice of their poets and narrators. In 1834, the researcher Milman Parry heard a Serbian bard, whose tradition is thought to be related to the ancient Greek manner of Homer, recite a poem as long as the Odyssey, and take 2 weeks to do so in twice daily sessions, each lasting 2 hours. This would not be done by remembering the poem line by line, but by a process of continuous recomposition. The bard was working with a knowledge of the narrative outline and an ingrained sense of the movement of the verse line. This given structure acts as a channel through which he could convey the story's larger and more detailed incidents. These, in turn, would include an array of formulae, which allow set repetitions of such things as the arrival of a messenger, how he is received, and how he delivers his missive. Description of natural objects and persons would also be made in appropriate given forms. So, these huge poems are being remade as their recitation goes along, but in accordance with strongly established conventions. In his The World of Odysseus, the historian, M.I. Finlay, reckons that about one-third of the Iliad and the Odyssey is composed of lines or blocks of lines that appear elsewhere in the poem. All of this shows us the importance of creativity in the recitation of oral poetry, and that performance is vital to it. Much nearer to our own time and experience, the process is somewhat similar to the way we might improvise the verses of a pop song whilst returning to the chorus, or the way football crowds adapt songs to hymn their club or particular players. Incidentally, the collective character of the composition of such songs and chants shows us another continuing feature of the oral tradition. The experience of the anthropologist, Dennis Tedlock, is interesting here as it highlights a further aspect of the relationship between oral performance, the full meaning of a work, and the nature of poetry's deliberate spaces as against conventional prose. In the 1960s, Tedlock set himself to record the narrative poetry of the Native American Zuni people in the southwestern United States. Transcribing his many hours of tape, Tedlock found himself dissatisfied by pages of written prose which seemed to capture so little of the experience he had heard. Most specifically, he writes, "There is no silence in it, and the varying pauses of the Zuni narrators, together with their varieties of level, are part of the body of the story." Consequently, influenced also by poetry readings in his own culture, Tedlock devised a written version of the Zuni stories set out in free verse. Lines to point the pauses, and with capitals and different letter sizes, indicating voice levels. "That's what you did, and you are my real mother." That's what he told his mother. At that moment, his mother embraced him. His uncle got angry. His uncle got angry. He beat his kinswoman. He beat his kinswoman. That's how it happened. The boy's dear elders were on the floor. His grandfather then spread some covers on the floor, laid them there, and put strands of turquoise beads on them. Tedlock's translations make use of the gestural features of poetry, including the deployment of white space on the page, to render what might otherwise have been thought of, especially had they been transcribed by pen rather than by tape recorder, as prose narratives. He found that prose doesn't capture performance, where varying emphases and plays of sound and silence are part of story and its meaning. Verse lines and the deployment of deliberate poetic spaces do. His experience, he writes, convinced me that prose has no real existence outside the written page, including Tedlock's collection of Zuni work. Jerome Rothenberg asserts, "We have forgotten, too, that all speech is a succession of sounds and silences, and the narrator's art, like that of any poet, is locked into the ways the sound and silence play against each other." It is exactly this interactive play of varyingly stressed sound and silence that constitutes the deliberate space of poetry. Out of the oral tradition, towards the page. As these instances suggest, the relationship between oral and written forms of poetry that certainly have their origins in the oral tradition is complex. As the editor and translator, Michael Alexander writes of the Old English epic, Beowulf. "It is likely that the poem had more than one oral stage, and more than one written stage." This has implications too for our conception of the authorship of poetry, which I shall discuss in Chapter 8. For the moment, however, I want to continue to explore the influence of the oral origins of poetry upon its shapes. In English, the ballad tradition carries all these complexities of origin and transmission. As a consciously defined tradition, this usually refers now to the gathering of poems by F.J. Child as the English and Scottish Popular Ballads, published between 1882 and 1898. However, the form had attracted a lot of literary interest and imitation much earlier, especially in the 18th century, and most prominently by William Wordsworth, 1770 to 1850, and Samuel Taylor Coleridge, 1772 to 1834, whose joint volume, Lyrical Ballads, appeared in 1798. Formally, the ballad is usually a poem that tells a story and is written in short stanzas. The stories tend to have simple plots, straightforward characterization, and are frequently dramatic and violent. They often featured encounters with the supernatural, love tragedies, sons lost at sea, and adultery. In America, the traditional ballad used the same or similar styles to tell stories of comparable characters, about such things as crime and natural disasters, as in these lines from the Ballad of Jesse James. "The people held their breath as they heard of Jesse's death, and wondered how he ever came to die. It was one of the gang called Little Robert Ford. He shot poor Jesse on the sly." Here are some lines from the medieval ballad, Little Musgrave and Lady Bernard, a tale in which the lady, having fallen in love with a young man at church, and he with her, takes him off to her bower at Bucklesfordbury, where thou's lig in mine arms all night. Told of this by a little tinny page, the Lord Bernard discovers them. With that my Lord Bernard came to the door, and lit a stone upon. He plucked out three silver keys, and he opened the doors each one. He lifted up the coverlet, he lifted up the sheet. "How now, thou little Musgrave, dost thou find my lady sweet?" I find her sweet, quoth little Musgrave. The more 'tis to my pain. I would gladly give 300 pounds, that I were on yonder plain. Arise, arise, thou little Musgrave, and put thy clothes on. It shall ne'er be said in my country, I have killed a naked man. I have 2 swords in 1 scabbard, full dear they cost my purse, and thou shalt have the best of them, and I will have the worst. Many of these ballads were very lengthy, and so it is necessary to quote at some length, to give an idea of how any incident unfolds. In these lines, we can see how the narrative is built piece by piece in each self-enclosed stanza. Lord Bernard arrives at the door, lifts the sheet, and here the repetition acts both as part of the reciter, singer's mnemonic, and as suspense. Musgrave's reaction, Bernard's chivalric challenge to a duel in 2 parts, the command to Musgrave to dress, and the donation of the better sword. Each of these stanzas has the same 2 features to its structure. First, each rhymes the 2nd and 4th lines, upon 1, sheet, sweet, and pain, plain. Rhyme schemes are conventionally notated in this example, AB, CB. Second, each has the same metrical pattern, that is the beat or stress, like the claps in the clapping song, falls upon syllables in each line in a way that corresponds to related lines. Again, we shall study meter more fully later, chapter 4. But broadly, this means that the 1st and 3rd lines contain 4 beats, and the 2nd and 4th lines, 3 beats. He lifted up the coverlet. He lifted up the sheet. How now, thou little Musgrave? Does thou find my lady sweet? This, then, is the marked-out working space of the ballad. To the singer, reciter, this pattern would be grooved as a channel in which to carry the narrative, a basic framework in which to fit details and devise variations, especially since it often includes pause recitations. It helps the performer recall the content, or, if necessary, improvise. In this stanza, we can see how it serves the purpose of the story. The key action is, of course, the lifting of the bedclothes, so lift and up are bound to carry stress, and their iteration lends suspense. The last line of the ballad stanza is often the punchline of that part of the narrative, and in this stanza, the key content is contained in the 3 words find, lady, and sweet. The rhyme, sheet, sweet, less expected than ballad rhymes often are, is brilliantly impressive, as it reveals Lord Bernard's sensual, sardonic psychology. The way his mock interest in Musgrave's experience of his wife is sinisterly controlled. Ballads are often represented as painting action and character with a very broad brush, but this detail, resting as it does in that 1 word, sweet, is wonderfully resonant. What we see in John Tedlock's work, transcribing Zuni stories and Child's record of the ballads, is the influence of the written word. Tedlock's experience is interesting in that he distinguishes between written prose and written poetry. As with the ballads, the original performances have nothing to do with such categories. But the 500 years since the advent of printing by movable type have made their demands and largely decided the way that ballads are now experienced as fixed texts. Print has been a centralizing and standardizing force, which is why so many social and political struggles have always centered around access to the press. In this context, it is not surprising that oral cultures have remained most important to groups with the least access to standard publication. The African-American blues tradition is one prominent instance, and, more strictly, in verse than in song, so is the oral poetry of the African Caribbean, especially Jamaica, both on its home ground and in the African Caribbean communities in Britain and elsewhere. This poetry is composed in dialect and is usually narrative, often using the manner of conversation to cover material ranging from outraged denunciation to neighbourly gossip. One example is the work of Louise Bennett, 1919 to 2006, who emerged in Jamaica in the 1940s. The poetry persists in both authored instances, such as Bennett's, and in traditional transmission, often of memorized verses hundreds of lines long. The verse scheme is usually similar to the ballad in that it uses a four-line stanza, rhyming ABAB, and either a four-beat line or an alternation of four and three beats. But in context, most important is the dialect, for in the shaping sound space of the poem, the ordinary language of the people proclaims its seriousness and demands respect. It returns pleasure and recognition to its own speakers and reminds standard speakers of the capacities of varieties of English other than their own. The space of the poem is thus doubly deliberate, first in its formal shaping, and then through this, as an act of cultural assertion. Valerie Bloom, 1956 to date, a successor to Louise Bennett, performs her work in character and often in costume, mobilizes the apparently lightsome qualities of her tradition to serious purposes. Here, she adopts the manner of a street gossip, telling a relative the story of a boy shot dead by police in a dispute at a picture house. Skillfully, she uses the repeated phrase, "I saw them say," or "so they say," to make an ironic comment on different versions of the incident. These are the last three verses of Trench Town Shock, "I saw them say," in which the teller describes how the official version is that the boy pulled a knife and was thus shot through the head in self-defense, something that happens often. "Still, nothing would have come from I. What do you think, Miss May? Did boy no pull out long knife, ma? At least I saw them say. Dem try, fi aim after him foot. But him head get in the way. The bullet go straight through him brain. At least I saw them say. Dry ye, ma. Me know I hat. But I happen every day. Knife man always attack armed police. At least I saw them say." Space on the page. The deliberate space of the poems we have looked at so far is created primarily by patterns of sound, and we follow the poems by ear. Sound is nearly always important to poetry, but with the wider dispersal of literate culture, the poem's effect is complemented by the shape of the space it occupies on the page. Now, I want to look at a series of poems in which the visual becomes of increasing importance. As I wrote in Chapter 1, we often turn to poetry in the midst of strong feeling, especially grief. Several of the poems we shall look at in the next few pages are linked by featuring tears. Although we are primarily concerned with the shapes of these poems, in theme and imagery, the globe of the tear might be said to occupy its own small space within the poetic tradition. "Lovely tear of lovely eye, lovely eye. Why dost do me so woe? Give me such woe. Sorrowful tear of sorrowful eye, sorrowful. Thou breakst mine heart a two. You break my heart in two." This beautiful little refrain from the mid-1300s, possibly a love lyric, but certainly part of a devotional poem to Christ, conveys its tender feeling with the most minimal deployment of four simple lines. It alternates four and three beat lines. though in the first and third lines, ensuring that the beats start the lines. Lovely tear of lovely eye, sorrowful tear of sorrowful eye. This ensures a heavier emphasis, an effect that pushes forward the sense of the expostulation of grief and mimes a tolling measure, befitting the mournful subject. Measure is a term often applied to poetry, and these lines, with their simple solid balance of these key stresses on key words, convey the powerful sense of being measured, in the sense of calibration and of restraint, whilst also holding the sense of bursting forth that is weeping. These common Old English words, lovely and sorrowful, are just allowed to impose their accumulated weight, both in the strong sound of consonant and vowel, and of their roots and associations of meaning in love and soreness. The second and third lines are differently, but no less strongly stressed. Why dost you me so woe? Thou breakest mine heart a two. But that slight difference opens a break in the beat through that unstressed why, which is almost like a tiny catch in the voice. Short, with obvious beats, and reiterated vocabulary, these four lines appear to make little inventive use of their space. And yet these minimal means achieve remarkable emotional power. Not weeping, but still lamenting, Geoffrey Chaucer, 1340 to 1400, in this poem with the interestingly paradoxical title, Mercil But, has a refrain of similar affecting economy. Your yen to wall slay me suddenly. Eyes will slay me suddenly. I may the beauty of him not sustain me. Survive. In these longer 10-syllable lines, counting yen as two, Chaucer gets the pain into his rhythm by obliging a tiny pause after yen and then accelerating the line through the sibilance of slee and suddenly. The second line has three beats, much stronger than the others, on beauty, not, and sustain, which intensifies the emotion after that apparently equable may. Sustain, which is made to rhyme in the whole with keen, green, and queen, seems to me a particularly effective choice, because it picks up the S sounds of slee and suddenly. The word in this sense of withstand, endure, is unusual, and thus gives the sense of the poet casting urgently about to find the proper word to convey the pressure. Again, a small space carrying a potent effect. But the pleasures of the poetic space can be less doleful. There once was a poet called Donne, who said, "Piss off" to the sun. The sun said, "Jack, get out of the sack. The girl that you're with is a nun." Not all limericks are so indelicate, although this one easily could be more so, and, as it has transmuted into a popular joke form, many are. The origins of the limerick are obscure, and it has always, it seems, migrated back and forth between written and oral tradition. The pattern, however, is broadly the same. Five lines with numbers 3 and 4 shorter, usually two beats, and a rhyme scheme of AABBA, especially because the form, like all joke formulae, has become so well worn, the first two lines can often use their length to produce a knowingly laborious, even pedantic quality. This must, however, then be recovered by the acceleration of the short lines, and, vitally, by witty surprise in the final rhyme. But in all cases, it is shape that satisfies, a fixed form within which wit can devise surprises. As always, the cadence or fall is a matter of timing. There was an old man of Nantucket who kept all his cash in a bucket, but his daughter named Nan ran away with a man. and as for the bucket, Nantucket. Another short form that shows the appeal of distinct shape is the haiku. Originally a Japanese poetic form, developed in the 13th and 14th centuries, it attracted Western imitation around 1900. Although there are variations both in the Japanese tradition and in Western practice, the commonest definition of the haiku is that it has 17 syllables, distributed over three lines in the pattern 5-7-5. Its interest for English language poets, especially for Ezra Pound, 1885 to 1972, and the Imagist poets of the early 20th century, is that its extreme compression purges verse of dilation and decoration in order to concentrate on a single noticed thing. Pound himself did not, in fact, write any true haiku, though the influence of the form can be seen in such poems as Alba, In a Station of the Metro, and the satiric squib, The New Cake of Soap. Later, the associations of the haiku with Zen Buddhism attracted the attention of poets exploring Eastern religion and philosophy, and the influential translations of R.H. Blythe of the Japanese poets Basho, 1644-94, Buson, 1716-84, and others represent the form in both shape and tone, but cannot always translate it exactly in terms of that syllable structure, the coolness, the voice of the bell, as it leaves the bell, Buson. The precision and pregnancy of the form makes it continually appealing, not least to parodists. The internet might be seen as a contemporary site for the oral tradition, and familiar frustrations with its technology are a frequent feature of its exchanges. The haiku seems an appropriate form to express such infuriation, as it suggests the brevity of computer commands and the technology's nearly mystical inscrutability. Here, composed in English, and thus able to follow the template exactly, are two of many in circulation. Windows NT crashed. I am the blue screen of death. None will hear your screams. With searching comes loss, and the presence of absence. My novel not found. Press exit in tears. We shall look in more detail at the set spaces poets use in Chapter 7 on the stanza. However, returning to the theme of tears and to Jack the Poet, the opening of John Donne's 1572-1631 farewell to his lover as he departs overseas. A valediction of weeping is a striking contrast to the simplicity of the haiku. Here we see a poet figuring a more elaborate space in which to work. Let me pour forth my tears before thy face whilst I stay here, for thy face coins them, and thy stamp they bear, and by this mintage they are something worth, for thus they be, pregnant of thee, fruits of much grief they are, emblems of more. When a tear falls, that thou falls which it bore. So thou and I are nothing then, when on a diver's shore. The idea of an enclosed space, the globe of his tear, containing the reflection of his lover, governs this stanza. It is then expanded in the poem's two succeeding stanzas, as the tear becomes first an image of the world, and then of the seas in which he might drown. The anguish of parting lies, in the sense of fragility, the imminence of their last moment together, and the possibility that the break might never be repaired, whether because of disaster or change of heart. The falling tear is an exact image of this fragility, and its enclosure is paralleled by the stanza that holds it. It opens with the outbreak of weeping carried by the bursting forth of that short first line, and ends with the dissolution of the tear as it hits the ground. Thou and I are nothing, then. The space between contains the speaker's urgent thoughts, as they tumble forward, stopping and starting, as he grasps at connecting words, whilst, for, when, that, so, to sort out his logic. Like the first line, the other two short lines are moments when the emotion is most forceful. They're heavy and irregular stresses, and crude be the rhyme punctuate the effort in the longer lines to hold back the fall of the tear, and so the parting, by inventing so much to see in it. All the anxiety about the relationship, brevity, fragility, is represented in the instant of the falling tear, held up, as though in slow motion, by the space between line 1 and line 9. It is interesting to ponder the degree to which such distinct shapes as the limerick and haiku are held in the poet, reader, or listener's mind, as sound or as a visual shape. My own sense is that since the printed page is so much part of our mental landscape, even the shapes of poems that arise out of the oral tradition, like the ballad stanza and the limerick, occupy a visual space in our imagination. Some early 16th and 17th printings of lyrics and sonnets drew a series of arcs down the right-hand margin, linking together the rhyme words in order to illustrate that there is a visual, normally an elegantly symmetrical pattern, to the poem that complements its harmonies of sounds. Drawing these arcs, and then turning the page through 90 degrees, the rhyming of some elaborate stanza forms, such as John Dryden's 1631 to 1700 Song for St. Cecilia's Day, can be seen to have a nearly architectural structure. Again, we shall look at this in more detail in Chapter 7 on Stanza, through a reading of Marianne Moore's 1887 to 1972 What Are Years? Visual shape, then, is the other dimension of the poet's deliberate space. Such shapes as the quatrain and the sonnet have a presence on the page and in the ear. But prior to their realization, they can occupy a distinct working area within the poet's mind during composition. For a variety of reasons, the poet's first motivation may be to write a sonnet or a villanelle, or some other set form. Less specifically, he or she may see the poem in the mind's eye at an early stage of its gestation as composed of quatrains, or six-line stanzas, or some other configuration, in the same way that the 20th century Russian poet Osip Mandelstam said that a poem first of all existed for him as a musical phrase ringing insistently in the ears. Even before the words came to him, Mandelstam, 1975. So poets might glimpse the beginning of a poem as a shape. All of the poetic forms have this visual, even sculptural, dimension. Emblems and concrete poems. Some poems, like the emblem poems of the 17th century, foreground the visual dimension by patterning the words on the page so as to present a visual image of the poem's subject. This is George Herbert's 1593 to 1633 Easter Wings. Lord, who createdst man in wealth and store, though foolishly he lost the same, decaying more and more, till he became most poor with thee, oh, let me rise, as larks harmoniously, and sings this day thy victories, then shall the fall further the flight in me. This is one of a pair of poems that can be read this way and turned through 90 degrees to present the image of two angels standing with wings outstretched. Emblem poems were often, although not exclusively, religious and aimed to convey their point briefly and vividly. in Easter wings, the outside, longer lines, treat the expansiveness of God, while the inside lines waste to the near vanishing point of human frailty. The poem's meaning, therefore, is carried both in word and image. In the 20th century, several poets have been drawn to this tradition. Among them, Dylan Thomas, 1914-53, with a number of poems both imitating Herbert's wings and inverting it to produce a diamond shape on the page. Geoffrey Hills, 1932-2016, Clavix, 2011, includes this deliberate homage to George Herbert, in which he plays with the image of the wings and an egg timer. Side on spread wings, upright an hourglass, better if egg timer, barely. A minute either way, this is our loss. Charles's. Fain tolls. Indecorous. Flesh restless to obey. Herbert times and twists, text hereby. Balanced glass wit, let tipple into grace. In another modern instance, John Hollander's, 1929-2013, Swan and Shadow, is figured as a swan on the water, together with its exactly inverted reflection. These poems all make use of visual effect to endorse the meaning. Concrete poetry of the 20th century may also do so, but many of its practitioners are most interested in the nature and variety of text. This is Edwin Morgan's, 1920-2010, Siesta of a Hungarian Snake. The poet and editor, Ricard Costellanets, defines text broadly as anything reproducible in a book. And since concrete poems have often appeared as posters or other forms of artwork, even his definition may be too narrow. In the 20th century, concrete poems have used the expanding resources of typography and modern printing techniques to emphasize the material nature of the poem and of words themselves. And the digital revolution enables yet more elaborate computer figurations. The page consists of, usually, white space in letter and or number forms. While there is only one kind of empty space, there are myriad forms, including, now that photographic means of mechanical reproduction are the norm, handwriting. The emphasis of concrete poetry, or text, in Costellanets's sense, is to weaken or remove the semantic properties of words, letters, and figures. That is, to reduce their attachment to meaning. Morgan's poem might not qualify as a pure concrete poem, since its effect depends on at least three things: a rudimentary knowledge of the character of the Hungarian language, which its clusters of consonants and apparent plethora of z's, our understanding of the word siesta and snake, and upon the onomatopoeic convention by which cartoons and comic strips denote snoozing. All these go together to create a verbal and visual joke. But José García Villa's 1908-97 Sonnet in Polka Dots is more inscrutable. Consider the first quatrain, which continues through the whole 14 lines in the classic 8 and 6 division of the sonnet form. Villa's text seems to be playing a game with the abstraction of poetic form. It is in the shape of a sonnet, but its content is zero. Matthew Welton, 1969 to date, elaborates a variation on Villa in his sequence Six Poems by Themselves, in which the 12 lines of each poem read dash dash dash, but with each poem comprising a different stanzaic pattern. Morgan's Hungarian Snake might also be considered a sound poem, That is, a work that takes the physiological qualities of voice sounds, whether they are words or are part of words, or onomatopoeic sounds like sss, or sounds with no semantic features at all as its key feature. Tongue twisters, such as Betty bought a bit of butter, but she found the butter bitter, so she bought a bit of better butter to make the bitter butter better, are close to sound poems since the consonants or vowels are so prominent. But they still use words, more radically, and towards the nonsense end of this spectrum, is Morgan's own hilarious performance poem, in which Nessie, the Loch Ness monster, slowly surfaces and returns to the depths. The poem consists simply of a series of bubblings, exhalations, and snorts from Morgan's virtuoso sinuses. Most recently, PC Multimedia offers resources whereby a poet might compose a text by making simultaneous use not only of the semantic properties of the words, but their typography and utterance, together with layerings of other sound and music, as well as images. Performance poetry. The prominence of the printed page and the book since the 16th century has perhaps served to obscure the continuing importance of the physical voice for poetry. Certainly, reciting aloud was a very important part of the life of poetry in the 19th century, and in contemporary poetic culture, performance has assumed a significant enough place for many towns and cities to have poetry nights of different kinds as part of their cultural scene. Many elements play into this phenomenon. Two of the most important from outside the metropolitan culture of the English-speaking world. The influence of the oral tradition of Jamaica and other parts of the Caribbean, already described, and its updating in a British urban context in the work of Linton Kwesi Johnson, 1952 to date, and other dub poets, is one of these, along with the rap poetry that has emerged from African-American culture, both showing the power of the fundamental characteristics of verse, of beat, and rhyme. Rap first emerged from the New York Bronx in the late 1970s, is a major part of African-American hip-hop culture. It has become the most popular dimension of contemporary poetry, and has been imitated, adapted, reworked, and disseminated well beyond its original source. Rap was the voice of this culture, the linguistic analogue of hyperkinetic dance moves, vividly painted subway cars, and skillfully mixed breakbeats. Rap was the first conclusion of a generation of creative people oppressed with the reality of lack, KRS-One explains. Hip-hop's pioneers fashioned in rap an art form that draws not only from the folk idioms of the African diaspora, but from the legacy of Western verse and the musical traditions of jazz, blues, funk, gospel, and reggae. These young artists commandeered the English language, bending it to their own expressive purpose. Editors Adam Bradley and Andrew Dubois, An Anthology of Rap. Introduction. The verbal dimension of rap makes insistent use of rhyme, powerful metric beat, repetition, and sometimes verse and chorus alternation. It is above all performative, and is inseparable from the voice and style of the MC, or rapper, and the surrounding musical beat, often composed of samples. The music does not accompany the lyrics, but is a dynamic part of the whole. The influence of popular music on poetry can be seen in one very simple borrowing, the microphone. Only at the rare, big traditional poetry readings might the reciting poet encounter, usually uncomfortably, a microphone. But for contemporary poets who see their natural context as the kind of club or performance space shared with bands, The microphone is a necessary tool, and one that enhances and stretches the capacity of the reciting, or, as it becomes, the performing voice. This is especially so in beatboxing, a poetic musical form in which the performer makes strong use of the microphone to enhance their voice, not only with words given a powerful beat, but also with other non-verbal sounds. A high-energy form which can include dance moves, the beatboxer may perform in a group setting, and sometimes within a narrative drawn from elsewhere. An offshoot of rap, it is, like rap, a modern variant of poetic form, whose origin lies in contemporary oral youth culture, independent of the tradition of poetry, but connected to it. So, drawing on these influences, and the poetry events of the beat poets of the 1950s and 1960s, performance poetry has grown to be a popular and highly visible part of the contemporary poetry landscape. The slam, in which poets compete against each other to win audience acclaim, has encouraged not only skill in the verse itself, but also greater actorly skills in voice, gesture, costume, and persona. But equally, the phenomenon of the open mic at performance poetry events embodies the ethos of performance poetry, the entertainment of a live audience, and an unmediated do-it-yourself openness towards expression and technical skill. Here, poetry lives alongside and sometimes fuses with other parts of the entertainment world, popular music and stand-up comedy. In many ways, it is the present-day space of the oral tradition in which poetry began. Conclusion. Always the poet is working between the poles of the minimal and the full, between economy and plentitude. The one side draws towards compression. How briefly can I put this? The other towards expansion, dilation. How richly, how extravagantly can I put this? Both extremes will eventually disappear into nothingness. Silence. The blank page, or an endless, shapeless spume of words. Between these poles, poetry uses conventions to demarcate and organize a space in time and or space. Perhaps space-time for the words to dwell. These bounds draw and intensify attention, just as the structuring of a joke will have us listening for and expecting the punchline, so the techniques of eloquence will have us straining for the key points of the argument, or the point of inspiration. All are verbal spaces, marked out deliberately with deliberation and for deliberation. The poet feels for a space that seems at once demanding and accommodating, whether given by tradition or made anew. It is a space marked for special attention. Indeed, poets accept outlines in order to achieve the powers of concentration and effect that come from limitation. John Crow Ransom, 1888 to 1974, argued, for instance, that formal measures obliged him to think harder, made him reject his first words because they would not fit, and therefore to discover other more interesting things that he would never have written had he not made himself meet the restrictions he had imposed upon himself. Tom Gunn, 1929 to 2004, puts it like this. As you get more desperate, you actually start to think more deeply about the subject in hand. So that rhyme turns out to be a method of thematic exploration. Gunn, 1993. Walt Whitman, 1819 to 92, on the other hand, in a spirit we might recognize in contemporary performance poets, sought to write as though there were never such a thing as a poem. In practice, the very decision to write poems presupposes some conception of what a poem is, and this will relate to the space and sound that it is, This does not mean, however, as Whitman demonstrated, that the expectations that compose any genre cannot be expanded and renewed in the work of new poets. Whether these shapes, short or long, are accepted from the existing tradition or invented anew, the poet will discover workable outlines to contain the work, the deliberate space of the poem. Summary. In this chapter, we have considered more of what is meant by gestural language, the nature of the oral tradition in poetry, and the importance of its devices for recitation and memorability. Children's rhymes, including the relation of clapping and poetic rhythm. The oral tradition in epic and narrative poetry, both ancient and modern, including the ballad, and its continuation in contemporary rap, beatbox, and performance poetry. The development of sound and shape as poetry moves from the oral to the page. Poems as visual artifacts.